This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, what we have to remember that even though Sweden is kind of perhaps the best pupil in the class, there's no pupil in this world class that has recognized that we need to decarbonize the world economy in roughly 35 years to 2050. So, you know, there's still work to be done also in my country.
I confess that sometimes I feel a little jealous of Sweden. How can they all be so good-looking and fluent in multiple languages, with universal healthcare and such modern, clean furniture designs? And don't even get me started on the meatballs. Today, however, we focus on how Sweden is experiencing global warming. Given its northern latitude, this Scandinavian Shangri-La is warming more rapidly than many other places in the world. Johan Rockström, one of Sweden's leading environmental scholars, joins us this week on Sea Change Radio to discuss his latest book, Big World, Small Planet, in which he details some of the approaches Sweden has taken to reduce carbon emissions and slow the progress of climate change. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Johan Rockström. He's the director of the Stockholm Resilience Center and a professor at Stockholm University. Johan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
I wanted to dive into your new book called Big World, Small Planet. Why don't you first kind of give us an overview of the thesis?
Yeah, sure. It is an effort of summarizing the remarkable advancements in our understanding of the human pressures on planet Earth over the past 30 years. So it's a summary of Earth system science showing the exponential rise in essentially every environmental parameter that matters for your and mine and the world's human well-being, of how it exponentially rises up as hockey stick patterns of pressure from climate change to loss of biodiversity, eutrophication, freshwater use, land degradation, etc., to the point that we today know with a very high degree of certainty that we've reached, you know, the biophysical limit. We're hitting the ceiling of the hardwired processes that regulates the whole Earth system. We've, to put it simple, reached a saturation point where the planet is starting to send invoices back to the economy in terms of, you know, shockwaves of extreme weather, sea level rise and floods and disease and loss of resources and collapse of fisheries. And this is a tipping point from, you know, a world that, even though we've been unsustainably managing resources for a very long time, we were still a relatively large, small world on a very large planet. So we could basically go on abusing without very major impacts. But since 1990 onwards, we've turned the page. And now we are, scientifically speaking, a relatively large world on a small planet. And this changes the entire paradigm for development. There's no room anymore. There's no, you know, untouched ecosystems anywhere on the planet. There's no more greenhouse gases that can be sucked up in the atmosphere or taken up in the ocean, or ice that can cope with more temperature rise without causing major invoices back into our lives and our economies. And this is the new mind shift we're trying to communicate in the Big World, Small Planet, where we're seeing that we need to reconnect our lives, our world, to the planet. So that's the key fundamental part. But then we, based on the latest science, we define what science has called the planetary boundaries, which is the boundaries beyond which we risk catastrophic changes on the planet, but within which we have a very high degree of chance of maintaining a stable and resilient planet. And we then write and give a lot of evidence in the book around all the, you know, opportunities we have to transform our lives, from energy systems to transport to consumer goods to food, of how we can not only, you know, live within a safe operating space without jeopardizing the planet, and at the same time deliver prosperity for humanity. So basically, we're trying to tell the positive story of a transition to a sustainable future for humanity, but that we are in a real, real dire situation right now.
Yes, you call it redefining the commons when you're talking about kind of looking at these common resources in a different light. Can you expand on that?
Yes, you know, we've built our economic logic, we've built our whole idea of nation states having sovereignty and control over their territories on the assumption that we are a small world on a very big planet. Basically, that the atmosphere and Antarctica and the ozone layer and large parts of the high seas are kind of externalities or global commons that nobody owns, but we basically for free have been allowed to pollute with greenhouse gases and plastics and chemicals and resources. And, you know, the bizarre thing is that this has actually delivered quite well. You know, you and I living in rich parts of the world have actually been able to subsidize our own well-being at the price of the commons that have been functioning as a kind of a waste bin, sucking up and simply taking a large part of this pollution, waste, and unsustainable exploitation.
Can you give me an example of some of the ways that somebody like myself here in San Francisco and somebody in Stockholm would be taking advantage of that commons?
Yeah, I mean, one very, you know, stark example today is that we know that our per capita very wealthy lifestyles requires, you know, in the order of 10 tons per capita per year of emissions of greenhouse gases to be able to allow ourselves to, you know, go by car, go by aircraft, consume both food and consumer goods, which require a lot of modern energy. Now, those emissions of greenhouse gases, believe it or not, but roughly half of them, in the order of 5 of the 10 that you and I emit every year, are taken up by the oceans and by trees and ecosystems. This is the world's largest subsidy to our own well-being, and we're not paying anything for that. The commons are taking the price. The atmosphere is sucking up, nature's sucking up, and oceans are sucking up. What happens with this? Well, you have global warming, and you also have tremendous rapid acidification of the oceans. The pH goes down, and the ocean gets more and more, you know, vulnerable. And this is an example of how our lives is kind of only possible so far due to the price the planet pays. But because this has been taken up by the global commons that have been, so to say, beyond anyone's private ownership or beyond anyone's responsibility, that has been the place where this has been taken up. And in fact, you can say the same story for plastic. You know, if we continue losing plastic waste at the pace of today, a recent report shows that we will, you know, in just 35 years, have as much plastic in the oceans as waste as we have fish in the ocean.
I just read that as well. That's incredible.
Which is absolutely incredible. So this is what we have been building into our economic logic, that, you know, in a small world on a big planet, that this kind of works. Now that we are a big world on a small planet, it works no longer because there's no more ocean to take up our pollution and our plastic and our waste. There's no more atmosphere to take up more of our greenhouse gases. We have filled up all the space. The planet cannot cope with anything more, so there's no more externalities. There are no more global commons. Everything is internal. In fact, for a finance minister in Sweden or the US, it's of equal importance whether we can manage jobs and growth within our national territory as it is important to maintain the rainforest in the Amazon, the rainforest in Borneo, the coral reefs outside of Indonesia, because all of these take up carbon dioxide, they keep rainfall patterns stable, and they regulate the whole planet. So this is the change, that there's no such thing any longer as global commons that you can, so to say, shove out of your national sovereignty and claim to be some kind of, you know, nobody's and therefore nobody's responsibility. The planet is now everyone's responsibility.
Satan didn't make To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Johan Rockström. So, Johan, in Sweden, we often think that this is a country that's exceptional in that you have high GDP and very educated populace. But maybe give us a glimpse of some of the stresses that climate change is having on your country.
Yeah, you know, climate change is affecting Sweden as it is affecting the U.S. We live in a part of the northern hemisphere, just like in the northern parts of the U.S., close to, you know, the high latitudes. So we have, in fact, a global warming which is roughly twice as rapid as the global average. So temperature rise in a country like Sweden is rather like 2 degrees Celsius so far, as compared to the 1 degree Celsius, the record level that we reached in 2015, which means 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit and 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit in Sweden. This has major impacts already today. We see plants and trees moving very rapidly towards the Arctic cycle. We see glaciers melting so fast, in fact, that fresh water is flowing in a much higher speed right into the Baltic Sea, which happens to be the brackish sea right out of my window, which is the livelihood for, you know, thousands of fishermen, tourism, and large parts of coastal economy in the riparian states, which includes, by the way, not only Sweden, but also Russia, the Baltic states, Poland, and Germany. And the risk is today we're seeing salinity levels going down because of the rising freshwater inflow from melting ice, which could kill off the fish in the Baltic Sea because, you know, the ecosystems, and remember that is the drama here. Everything you and I know of nature, everything you and I love of nature, from rainforest to meadows to wetlands to my Baltic Sea outside of this window, established itself after the last ice age and has been stable thanks to the very slow incremental changes in temperatures and water flows that we've seen naturally occurring over these thousands of years. And now suddenly we're changing things so fast that we're seeing, even in Sweden, very rapid changes in both nature and in temperatures and in the ocean. So that's one part. The other obvious observation here, which you have as well in the US, is that we see a higher frequency of extreme weather events. These are very difficult, as you know, to prove that this is caused, so to say, only by human-induced climate change. But, you know, science shows clearly that it is natural variability. Of course, we always have, weather events coming up and down, but they're reinforced and cannot any longer be delinked from the fact that we have raised the temperature. So we see higher extremes. You know, I can tell you, it has never in my adult life been so warm as it is right now in January. You know, we have like almost 10 degrees Celsius, 20 degrees Fahrenheit in the cold, normally cold Stockholm. But can you believe it? Just 1 week back, we had almost the coldest observation, you know, since the Second World War. So it goes in very, very drastic extremes, which is exactly what science has predicted is something we can expect.
And one of the things that you don't have in your country is a large climate denying movement, which is trying to squash and squelch any kind of innovation and allowing humans to be able to adapt to these rapidly changing realities. Can you spell out some of the more effective policies that Sweden has mapped out for the near and long-term future?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. And this is, in fact, I should start by saying that I have the privilege of leading an international center doing research on sustainable development, and we have many of our absolute top colleagues in the U.S., you know, from Stanford in the West Coast to Princeton on the East Coast. So I have great respect for the science and the innovation and, you know, enormous capacities and developments in the U.S. But this said, it is quite remarkable that you're absolutely right. You know, in Europe, denialism is dead. The science is so well established, and policymakers, corporations, individuals in general have come to a point since many years where they, you know, respect and accept the scientific diagnostic and also see the evidence just outside of the window. And that is now very important because it creates a high degree of ability of the political leadership and corporations to actually take a step forward. In the US, you're right, you're still seeing much more of pockets, at least, of denialism, even though I'd like to emphasize that even, you know, opinion polls in the US shows that under the surface of your quite manipulated media at times and some of the, outspoken political voices, you also have a very high degree of support for action on climate change among your American co-citizens. But that said, Sweden is certainly a country where there's no denialism left at all. You know, it's a constructive country. Every political party in this parliament, I actually sat in a debate just today with the leader of the right-wing, most conservative, most liberal, most corporate supportive party leader, and she says, the big challenge and opportunity for Sweden is now to create jobs and economic growth by investing in sustainable prosperity in this country. You know, this is quite exciting to see, and she's basing this, as you know, on so much evidence. A country like Sweden today sees business leaders and investments moving towards sustainable entry point towards business solutions because it makes sense. You know, renewable energy technologies are growing very rapidly, particularly wind, hydro, biomass, some solar, because it simply competes economically with fossil fuels and makes the country more independent. You see a shift towards sustainability being a very, you know, strategic and central part of the business logic. And Sweden has always been a liberal market economy, and it uses sustainability as a way of being even more innovative and even more, you know, modern in its technological advancements. And then let me say just a little anecdote that you may have heard of Spotify, which is one of the, you know, big music sharing digital companies in Sweden. You know, Sweden invented both Skype and Spotify.
Sure.
And I talked quite recently with the founding CEO of Spotify, you know, that streams roughly 40% of all music in the world today. And he is one of the most, you know, rapid employing companies of talent, young talent in Sweden today. And he says, what is it that makes me so attractive as an employer? Well, I can tell you, he says, it's not only because Spotify is an exciting company to work at, it's because Stockholm is such a livable city. And why is Stockholm so attractive for, you know, international, well-educated young people from the US and from other parts of the world? Well, it's not only because Stockholm is a beautiful city, it's because you have clean air, you have clean water, you have silent transport systems, you have very good public service, you have good cycling systems, and you have stability and you can rely on the political system. So, you know, the livability has a lot to do with these ecological, social, and geopolitical trust-based variables that we actually have to, you know, nurture very, very carefully.
And unfortunately, it's not as cold as it used to be.
That's right. Actually, the paradox is that, you know, for someone like me who's lived in Sweden, parts of my life, at least I've been in Africa for a long time, is, believe it or not, but, you know, when you have good snow cover, really cold, as you certainly know, that's an easier climate to cope with than this damp, rainy, +1 degree Celsius, 2 degrees Fahrenheit type climate, which feels more cold because it's so incredibly humid.
And your feet get wet and it turns to slush and mud. And it's not as enjoyable as the pristine white snow of a cold precipitation, right?
Exactly. And remember that this is so far north that we barely have any sun. So one of the key sources of light is actually the snow, the white cover. As soon as the snow is gone and melts, it gets much, much darker, I can tell you.
So getting back to this right-wing politician from Sweden. This is the James Inhofe of Sweden. He's a senator from Oklahoma, which is a big fracking state, and he brought a snowball to the floor of the Senate to demonstrate that global warming is not real because he has this snowball in his hand. So, but this is, your equivalent is much more aware. What about the other side of the aisle? What are some of the more radical ideas that are being embraced by the left wing of Sweden's policymakers?
Yeah, you know, so right as we speak, well, let me start by saying that Sweden has, since 1990, so, you know, for 26 years, had a federal price on carbon at the highest level in the world. And it's so high that you will almost lose the mic when I tell you. It has been on average at over $100 per ton of carbon dioxide. And this was, introduced in 1990 with a bipartisan support by both right wing and left wing. And it was done thanks to, you know, raising the tax on carbon and lowering it on jobs and income. And, you know, this has been now operating for more than a generation, essentially. And what has it led to? It led to decoupling with very rapid economic growth and reduction of environmental impacts. So this has led to a revolution in terms of the way we heat and the way we distribute electricity in the country, from oil and coal to technologies that were developed innovatively by using residual from the big pulp and forest industry in Sweden, which is now used as a way of transforming to electricity and heat. So, and this has never been a political discussion, neither in the conservative or the socialist camp. So that is just on the history. Where are we then today? Well, today we have a social democratic government. We have a prime minister who sees as the next project for Sweden that sustainability, I mean, not only climate change, but really innovations in, for example, circular economic models to use very innovative technologies to recycle all the rare earth metals in computers, or recycle all the textiles in clothes from H&M, or the furniture in IKEA, is being launched increasingly as a strategy for the next step for the prosperity and growth and jobs for the Swedish economy. And this is, of course, still there's some debate and planning on how exactly the investments in this would happen, but it's actually a very open and wide support in the parliament that sustainability and sustainable development is a path towards well-being, and investments are made basically in the designing of the urban infrastructure here. And it's going, between you and me, still a bit too slow in some parts, because, you know, what we have to remember, that even though Sweden is kind of perhaps the best pupil in the class, there's no pupil in this world class that has recognized that we need to decarbonize the world economy in roughly 35 years to 2050. So, you know, there's still work to be done also in my country.
Searching for the future among the things we're throwing away. Trying to see the world through the junk we produce every day. They say nothing lasts forever, but all the plastic ever made is still here. No amount of closing our eyes will make it disappear. If I could be anywhere, if I could be anywhere, if I could be anywhere in history, I would want to be here.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Johan Rockström. If we can look at Sweden as a greater Scandinavian region, maybe you can give us a snapshot of some of the different opposing views from, like, an oil-rich nation like Norway, or where are the disagreements and where are the commonalities in terms of policy?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I mean, in general, all the Scandinavian countries take the environment very seriously, both politically, but also have it kind of inbuilt in their core culture. I mean, nature really matters for the life quality in all these nations. But there are big differences, as you point out. Finland and Sweden are actually those with the most similar situation. These are countries that are, so to say, have no oil resources, and both countries depend very much on managing their coast in the Baltic Sea and their forests. And they both actually have nuclear power and take both climate and sustainable development in equivalent or very similar way. Norway, on the other hand, is very different, of course, because despite having an incredibly strong focus on the environment and managing its wonderful fjords and its coastal regions and its beautiful nature, freshwater, air, biodiversity, you know, potentially even more seriously than Sweden, it is an oil nation. So it's an oil nation and therefore has this almost schizophrenic situation of, on the one hand, taking climate science very seriously, but on the other hand, depending on oil for its own economic development. But what Norway has done, as you may be aware, is to prepare itself for a transformation away from fossil fuels by establishing the world's richest pension fund, which is the oil fund, owning a very large portion of the revenue from oil. So they're actually preparing themselves for that transition. Denmark, on the other hand, goes a little bit back and forth, and it has to do with the political landscape there. So it has gone just a few years back from being a very conscious country on the environment to today actually having a government that engages a bit less in climate and the environment. But however, you know, we Swedes tend to sometimes blame the Danes for not being as good as us Swedes. But I, you know, every time I go to Copenhagen, I recognize that this is the best urban place on this planet for cycling, for example. I mean, they've come a long way in integrating sustainable lifestyles into their modern living. And that is quite impressive. But it, you know, it differs a bit between the countries. But overall, the Scandinavian countries take these issues very seriously and act together, for example, in the climate negotiations.
So with your book, Big World, Small Planet, how does that fit within this discussion? What are you trying to achieve with it?
Yeah, you know, I'm a scientist, and I've come to recognize, as many of my peers, that pumping out facts and the rational diagnostic of risks is not enough. You need to combine and reach both the brain and the logic with your heart and the emotions. And this book tries to combine science with photography and storytelling to be able to have a deeper mind shift and reach out to people's, you know, compassion, the moral engagement, and coming to perhaps a bit surprising conclusion that after all this science, the number one conclusion is that if we can manage the remaining and take care of the remaining beauty on our fantastic little planet, we stand actually a very good chance of having a prosperous future for humanity. So that's the key here, to experiment with this link between the logical and the emotional.
Johan Rockström, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Jimmy McGriff, The Rolling Stones, and Jackson Browne.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.